This week on Writers, Inc.
The more I didn't sell, the more determined I was that I eventually would. I just kind of dug in and thought, I'm going to do this somehow, and stuck to it, and I'm glad I did.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I can finally talk about it. So the press release came out a couple of days ago, so it's out there in the wild by the time this airs. But 4MK has been optioned again. This is option number 4.
Oh, wow.
But I am very optimistic about this one. Sylvester Stallone's company, Balboa Productions, picked it up.
Exciting.
Nice.
Yeah, we've been talking, you know, behind the scenes about this for a while, and they've put together a pretty solid team. They brought in a woman named Channing Powell. Did you guys watch Walking Dead?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she was behind a lot of the Walking Dead, you know, the original and all the sequel series. And they brought her in as the showrunner and the lead writer. And why that's important is because they optioned all the books in the series. So they optioned the original trilogy and the prequel books that I'm writing the hopes of putting out a primary series for the original trilogy with a spinoff series, using the prequels. Mm-hmm. But like all that has to be, you know, like it's all very tangled together. I can't think of a better person to do that because like she did such a great job with it on Walking Dead. So I am very optimistic about this one. After 4 options, this is the first time where it actually feels like it might actually get made.
Wow, that's very exciting. Christine is going to be so mad she wasn't here to talk about it.
Well, I've been talking to you guys about it, but you know, it's one of the, like, the folks in Hollywood get very upset if you mention anything ahead of them. We put the press release together like almost a month ago. They sent me the first draft and they asked me for some graphics and stuff. And like, I thought it was going to come out like a month ago. And like, it didn't come out. It didn't come out. Like I went off to Spain and it still didn't come out. And then I got an email a couple of days ago saying we're going to get it out before Memorial Day. So it's crazy how much that ignites stuff because mm-hmm. I just searched my name on Google and like it created like 3 pages worth of Google results.
Nice.
Wow.
And that's just in English. Like if I go into other languages, you know, they're talking about it in the Netherlands and Spain and Spanish and like all these other languages. So it's pretty wild.
Oh, that's actually really cool.
On the lowered expectations end of the spectrum, P23 Films, which optioned 2 of my IPs, released their trailer on Tuesday and sent me a link. So that's floating around out there now with all the properties that they're representing. But they for whatever reason, they went very prominent with my Kotler books on their like website and on the in the trailer. I got a lot of play. And I was surprised too because he's like, "Hey, take a look at this video," and I'm watching it and it. Sounds like it's about this evangelist guy. That's what I thought this was about. And then suddenly I showed up and I'm like, what am I doing in this thing?
That's the name of your autobiography. And suddenly I showed up.
So not nearly as cool as having Rocky.
Rocky Balboa.
He's the ultimate underdog.
Yeah. That's really exciting. Underdog,
yeah. Yeah, he's one hell of a businessman too. If you get a chance, pick up his book and just read about his history. But like the things that he did to sell that initial Rocky script are just insane. Like at one point he was so broke he sold his dog for $40 because he couldn't afford to feed the dog anymore and he needed to eat. But then he bought his dog back for like $15,000. Like he paid whatever he had to get it back. Like after he sold the script.
He is forgiven and redeemed, as I should have known he would.
It was. Yeah, like if you read the story, like the whole, like he was thinking about the dog, you know, like I can't feed my dog. It was a big dog, you know, like he couldn't take care of it. He's like, I don't want to do it, but like, this is better for the dog. And then that's why he did it. And like, yeah, if you're a pet owner, like you can relate to that, but cool to buy it back the way that he did. Like, I don't care what it's going to cost. I want my dog back. So
that says a lot. Yeah. I judge everybody by whether or not they like dogs. So
me too.
You'd be surprised, like pet owners in general, like it tells you a lot about their character, like the way they treat their pets. All right. What is in the real news?
Well, speaking of pet owners, I'll let you figure out how that relates to this. Bloomsbury AI agreement. Bloomsbury Publishing is asking authors to opt into a new AI addendum that would let the publisher license books for AI training and development. The language is extremely broad, covering reproduction, adaptation, excerpts, and future AI technologies, with authors receiving 20% of the publisher's net receipts. Critics on the Authors Guild forum say the wording is too expansive and vague. Some worry it could allow AI companies to generate derivative works, sequels, or new content based on an author's fictional universe, while authors receive only a small and potentially opaque share of the revenue. Others argue that the industry is inevitably moving toward AI licensing and believes it's better for publishers to negotiate proactively rather than leave authors out entirely. The debate really comes down to trust and long-term risk. Some authors see AI licensing as a practical new subsidiary right, while others fear signing away valuable creative control before anyone fully understands how AI-generated publishing ecosystems will evolve. I'm kind of in that last bullet.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of stuff makes me really nervous. I mean, even with like this Balboa thing, like there's a big vetting process to make sure that all the rights are available. You know, like they don't just take my word for it. The lawyers get involved and they search every previous contract and look at all these things. And if somebody is overstepping on a contract like this, they could actually keep you from doing something else later. That you might be able to do now. And, you know, a lot of this stems from like when ebooks first came out, like publishing contracts didn't have any kind of language in them to deal with ebooks. So publishers had to circle back and do addendums with existing authors. And then they created this really broad, far reaching language for new authors, which, you know, agents pushed back on. And then it kind of got fine tuned into what it is today. But it feels like they're doing that again with AI. So just be very cautious with what you sign.
Yeah. Yeah, I am concerned about it, using it to create derivative works that I don't get paid for. That would be, that's a stab and offense in Kevin's world. So putting that out there. Next up, Minotaur responds to the, quote, last Mandarin printing snafu. Minotaur Books accidentally skipped the indie inclusive edition of The Last Mandarin, missing 6 pages of bonus content, including part of the author's special introduction and extra material created specifically for independent bookstores. Instead of delaying release day, the publisher chose to provide QR codes linking to the missing content online and promised physical replacement pamphlets later. Some indie booksellers were understanding, but many felt the response was inadequate, especially because Louise Penny's audience skews older and may not want to use QR codes. The controversy tapped into a larger frustration among indie bookstores. Several booksellers argued a major chain like Barnes & Noble likely would have received a full reprint instead of a workaround. I actually That's have true. Bought books from Barnes & Noble that were missing entire chapters from the middle of the book, so I don't know that that's true.
Well, they will once it's been like flagged, they'll do it. There was a book once that came out and a big chunk of it was printed upside down in the book. And once they realized that, they did a massive reprint, and all you had to do is take your book back to Barnes & Noble and they would exchange it out for the updated copy. So
see, but those books are going to become valuable.
If you keep it, yes, because then, you know, but a lot of people don't want to collect. They want to read, and it's, you know, you don't want to have to turn your book around.
I print all my ebooks upside down, every one of them.
Well, this kind of thing comes down to, you know, like who's financially responsible. Like that's how these decisions are made. You know, like what you're talking about, you know, if something gets a printing problem, then the printer is on the hook for that. So, you know, the publisher has no trouble, you know, no problem recalling those books, you know, telling Barnes & Noble, send them all back. We'll send you new ones because somebody else is going to foot that bill. But when content is left out like this, that's most likely the publisher's problem because they receive a final pages file that they have to go through that basically gives them every page that's going to be in the book. You have to sign off on it. And, you know, once you sign off on that, that becomes, you know, what is used to create the book. So if somebody signed off, you know, I'm assuming on this book without that content in there, then it went through the print process. And, you know, at that point, they've already paid for the print run. You know, so if they do anything, they're going to pay for it. So it's easier to just say, well, let's just go ahead and ship them. If it becomes a problem, we'll deal with it. You know, rather than footing the bill up front, they're, you know, postponing it, hoping that they're not going to have to pay for it later.
Yeah, that is interesting because the content wasn't going to ever go to like someplace like Barnes and Noble, right? So they're just speculating that that's what would happen because it was indie bookstore content. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of speculation happening here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fair enough. All right. The perils of publishing.
Well, if all the readers are older generation readers, they'll be okay with pamphlets. Old people like pamphlets.
They do like
could fold it like an old McNally map. They'll be on board.
Subscription addiction. Special edition books exploded because of fantasy and romance subscription boxes like Fairy Loot, Owlcrate, and Illumicrate, which built huge fan communities around sprayed edges, embossed covers, and collectible redesigns of popular books. Publishers are now fully copying the trend, treating deluxe editions as what one subscription box founder called a, quote, fifth format, alongside hardcover, paperback, ebook, and audiobook. Many romanticy books now launch with premium collector editions from day one. The article raises the question of whether these books are becoming the, quote, fast fashion of publishing, mass-produced luxury collectibles that people display more than read, with some readers spending thousands of dollars a year chasing exclusive editions.
I wouldn't know anything about chasing pretty sprayed edged editions of books or anything.
I feel you're a big offender of this.
I am. I think this is actually exciting. Like, first of all, like from an author perspective, I mean, yes, you always want someone reading your book, but I mean, also practically speaking, sales are sales. If they're buying your book because they want to put the pretty edges on the shelf, you know, I mean, let them buy the books, like let them have them. But
then
I love
why
it.
Why put any words in it at all then? I'm just going to start releasing sprayed edge books. Hey,
I read them. but I will likely buy the special edition and then do an ebook so that I can read it and keep the special edition pristine. But like if I'm on the fence about buying a book and it has sprayed edges, like, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I will likely buy it because I will more than likely read it eventually because it's on my shelf and I like it and I look at it and it's pretty.
Yeah. So do you have multiple copies of the same print book?
Yes. Yeah. Of most of the special editions. Yeah. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Yeah.
So you just really like the book and if they put out some new special thing, you're going to buy it and just to have it as part of your collection.
Yeah, so some of them, like, I have, you know, like, if I like them, like, I've got a Red Rising, so, you know, they come out with special editions. I bought that, so I have, like, a normal one, and then they came out with it. With the ones now that they're coming out more and more, if it sounds like something I'll read and it has a special edition, I'll buy it. And then if the special edition comes out later and it's a book that I absolutely loved, like, I will 100% buy it. So, like, I'm a pretty easy target when it comes to sprayed edges.
I just had a genius idea, JD. We need to start signing our books on the pages, on the edges. Just close the book, sign the edges. That way it's a sprayed edge book. They can display it.
I'm thinking back to my days working in the music business. Like we did this back then, but like we, you know, release a CD and then when it started selling really well, we put out another CD, a version of that with two bonus tracks that you could only get on that special edition. Then there would be another one that had, you know, the explicit lyrics versus the, you know, tame lyrics and like, and any iteration of that book or that album that we could come out with, we would do. And like, I'm talking to some people right now about a box set for 4MK in the States, because they've been doing them in a lot of other countries and they're doing well. And I've got a chapter that I pulled out at the end of the fourth monkey. We basically just cut it out because it just didn't need to be there. But I've always marketed it as the lost chapter. And like, I used it for my Patreon page, you know, like if you subscribe to Patreon, you could get access to it. So like if we do a special edition, I'll probably put it back in there, you know, just to have something different. But I like it. I've got a few, like, I probably have 7 or 8 copies of Dracula, you know, just different editions. And I finally, you know, broke down and bought like a first edition just to have it. But I'm bad like that too. I will collect books.
Yeah.
Do you have the special edition hardcover with the two puncture marks in the side?
There are no puncture marks, but it's an ugly, I'll have to dig it out so you can see it, like mustard colored cover. It doesn't look like it belongs to Dracula. The pages are falling out because it's, you know, 100 some years old. But I just wanted it, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think they're pretty, and I think that, you know, they look very nice when they're all on the shelf and you can see them, and it, like, you know, and some of them like go together. They make like, you know, it's not like just one book that has the printed edges, like the trilogies, they'll like match them. There's some cool things that you can do. I think they're, yeah,
For those of you not watching us on YouTube, so Jenna's got her books basically facing out backwards, right? Like you've got the sprayed edge facing out instead of the spine. Which actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it makes it, I don't know, it makes me happy. I guess I'm a book crow. I see sprayed edges, I buy sprayed edges.
All right. Well, that's it for the news. JD, who we got up today?
This week, we've got Lori Foster coming on. Lori is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author whose sexy contemporary romance novels have sold over 10 million copies worldwide. Her latest novel, The Lake House, releases May 26th. And here she is to tell us all about it, Lori Foster.
So, Lori, you have a new book out, The Lake House, that we're going to talk about in a minute. We have a lot of writers who tune into the show, so we like to start at the beginning. You've been in this business for what, like 30 years now? Is that accurate?
I guess probably something like that. Yeah, 96 was my first book was out. My husband just said 31 years. He's
31 years. He's the numbers guy. Yeah, and you've hit all the lists. You've got out more than 100 titles. But let's start at the beginning. How did you get started writing?
So, I hadn't even been much of a reader. I never really found books that I liked until I got sick one time and my sister brought me over a bag of romance and women's fiction. And, you know, I read the first one and I was hooked and I became a voracious reader. But as much as I loved the books, there was always something I wished had gone just a little bit differently in the story. So I decided to just play around and write my own, only for myself. And, you know, just kind of entertaining myself with it. And my stepmother came by with my dad one day and they saw what I was doing. I always tried to hide it. I didn't want anybody to know I was like a closet writer. You know, I had 3 young boys I was raising and my husband and I were constantly busy with sports and school and all those things. So I just kind of did it as my leisure time. And when they found out, they were very, very encouraging. And then my stepmother saw where there was going to be a writer's conference in the area. And she wanted me to go to it, and I did. And at that point, I'd already written several books, again, just for myself, longhand. You know, this was longhand, pencil and paper. And as I was talking to different people, I realized that a lot of them were still working on chapter one. Mm. And here I had, so I knew that I could finish a book, didn't know if it was any good. You know, then I had to go through the process of getting first a typewriter, then a word processor, and then finally computers came around. So editing was a real pain back then. And I started submitting books, figured out how to do that. You know, back then without the internet, we didn't even know what format to do or where to send it. So I had a lot I had to learn. Yeah. And took me 5 years to publish the first one, to get it sold. But it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years, that's a long time to try and get that first book sold. And back when I learned to type, I learned on a typewriter as well. That I'll date myself as well. Those were the days when you're sending out queries to agents in paper. So was that like,
right.
Yeah. And 5 years of doing that is not, not cheap and it's time intensive.
So over the 5 years, I
Yeah.
sent out 10 different books. So I had a lot going out there. And back then, there were more publishing houses. So I was constantly sending. Someone would write back and say, you know, we really like your voice, but could you do this? And so I was very much just entertaining myself for the most part. The last little bit before I finally sold, I got pretty antsy about it. And again, dating myself, we didn't have answering machines.
Yeah.
So if the phone rang, my heart would jump and I wouldn't let the kids sit on the phone very long because I was afraid I'd miss an important call. And then, you know, when I finally did get that call, you would think it would have been really, really exciting. And it was just such a relief to, you know, the more I didn't sell, the more determined I was that I eventually would.
Yeah.
I just kind of dug in and thought, I'm going to do this somehow. And stuck to it. And I'm glad I did. And, you know, you sell that first one and you think, all right, now I know what I'm doing. Well, and then, you know, it took me a while to sell the second one. So, but then I did start getting multi-book contracts. So that helped after that.
Back in the day with the no voicemail, and we used to just play phone roulette. You didn't even know who was calling, right? There's no caller ID. I am old enough to remember that. So how do you keep yourself going over 5 years and just sending things out? Where does that determination come from? Or is that just like, yeah.
I always had too many ideas for one thing, but I also, like I said, I had three sons, so I stayed so busy. I was always very involved in the school, the PTO, school carnival. You know, was class mom, went to all the field trips, and then they were all in sports. So my life was pretty full, and I've got a wonderful husband. So my
Yeah.
life was pretty full and well-rounded. This was sort of just the extra fun fitting things in. And I, of course, was reading voraciously at the same time too. I just went through books like crazy. So as much as I wanted to sell, my happiness was never dependent on selling. I just really wanted to prove that I could.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would finish one, I'd send it out, and I'd immediately start another one.
Yeah.
And my mother passed away with cancer during some of those time periods. And writing was sort of my escape and my vacation and my entertainment. It was just all of those things. I mean, I genuinely enjoy it. So even if I never sold another book, I would still write because I do it as much for me as for anyone else.
Yeah, I love that. Like loving all the other parts of your r life, not having all your identity in writing and loving
Right.
writing and having all that support. That's very well rounded. And 10 books before you got that first one published. That's fantastic. So you were busy. When did you fit writing in when you were doing that? Like, where did you find time to do that?
So I'm one of these people now that I always get up about 4 or 4:30 in the morning, and that came about because of getting up before the kids would get up for school. So I would get up and fit in writing then, and then once they were out the door to school, I was a very tidy housekeeper. So I would tidy my house and, you know, then spend some time writing, spend some time reading. You know, I look back and I don't know how my husband and I did it. He would work third shift and he would come home with no sleep, and we would go to a sporting event, and we just young and energetic, you
Yeah.
know, not old and tired like I am now.
Yeah.
We pretty much ran and ran and ran. I talk about people that are very unhappy with their lives, and I think if you were as busy as we were, you didn't have time to be unhappy with your life. You were just living your life because you had so much to do,
Yeah.
you know. And I think I've always been a very, very thankful person. So if you have three healthy kids and a wonderful husband and a roof over your head, writing is just a perk. You
Yeah.
know, you've already got the world by the tail. So all the other stuff is just the extras that are fun. You know, I've said before, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart, if I never sold another book, I could still be a very happy person.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I.
because that's my happiness isn't dependent on that. That said, boy, I love being a writer and I love selling. And my readers are so amazing and so much fun, and they keep me entertained. And they're just, this industry has to be the kindest group of people ever. The authors, the editors and agents, and the readers, they're just a group all their own. You know, just very, very empathetic and understanding and caring people.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. The writing community is fantastic and helpful and cheer you on and all that good stuff. So, did you find your first agent then just by sending out, like mailing out a query? Is that how you got your first agent?
So I think I sold two books before I got an agent.
Okay.
Because back then you could do that.
Yeah.
People will ask me for advice on writing now, and it's so different from what it was
It
back
is,
then.
yeah.
There's really not a lot that I can tell them because it's changed so much over the decades. But so I got my first agent. I've had quite a few agents. I tended to flip around if things weren't going quite the way I wanted them to. And then I would stay with an agent for a good long while until I felt like I needed to switch things up again. And did that not too long ago with Mark Gottlieb at Trident. I'm very happy with him. But I was happy with who I had before that, and I was happy with who I had before that. I'm a big believer that if things start to move in a direction you don't want, you have to make changes.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
Yeah, I think that's the part we don't talk about a lot. Like most writers who have been in the game for a while have had more than one agent. Not all of them, but most of them. And that's kind of part of the business, right? And things shift and evolve and maybe you go a different direction. And yeah. So,
Well,
okay.
you have different publishers, so I've been with many different publishing houses too. I started with Harlequin, and then I spent quite a few years with Kensington, loved Kensington. I was with Berkeley for quite a while, which I think is called Penguin Putnam now. I'm not sure. They keep changing names on
Right.
me.
Yeah.
And then was with Kensington, and then I went back to Harlequin, and now I'm back at Kensington. So, you kind of bounce around with, I don't know, readers probably don't know, but you get offered a contract. And so whoever has the best contract that meshes best with what you want to do is generally who you go with.
Yeah, exactly. So now let's talk about your latest book. You have a new book out, The Lake House. It is the second book in your Firefly Lake world.
Yeah, Firefly Summer Series, yeah.
Yeah, because the first book was a different character than the second book, which I like that. It's in the same setting, but kind of a different focus. So this one is Second Chances, Secrets, Unexpected Love. You've written so many books. How did you know this was the idea that you wanted to write next?
I never know where ideas come from.
Yeah.
I can just be sitting there minding my own business, and boom, there'll be an idea in my head. And for this particular series, the first book was the first one was The Guest Cottage, and it was about learning to forgive other people who'd done you wrong and finding your happy place. And then this one, and each book completely stands alone, but you in the same town. This book is about forgiving yourself for mistakes that you made, because we all make mistakes. And we should be as generous with ourselves and as strict with ourselves as we are with others. And I'm a big believer in that. And I think something I like to carry over in my books is that sometimes life takes you in a direction that you think is all wrong. You think that things have gone off the rails and you're in a dark place, and then suddenly a door opens and you realize maybe you were headed in the right direction all along. And so that's what this series is. All three books will have that overriding theme that you end up in the place you were always meant to be, even though you have to go through some pretty rough patches to get there.
Yeah. And yeah, you have both of these characters have that in different ways. You have, a young mother who maybe made a couple of mistakes with that, and then you have military. I don't want to spoil too much, but they kind of get together. Yeah, the characters are great. Do you kind of have different characters separate from the story, or do the story and the characters kind of meld together, or how do you pick who is suited for who?
So when I was writing the first book, I didn't really know about the character that's in this book until she showed up. And that happens to me a lot. I knew that she was going to have had problems with her in-laws
Yeah.
and with her ex-husband, but I really didn't know that the woman that her husband had had an affair with was going to show up at her door in desperate need, which is what this book has. Didn't know that she would be so young. I didn't know that they would become good friends. I kind of just start with an idea, and then I start. It's like if I take a walk in the woods, I don't know what I'm going to find while I'm out there, but I'm sure I'll find something that'll entertain me.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I write. So I get started with basic character sketches in my head that I also put on my computer so I can remember things about them. And then I just sort of turn them loose and let them take me where they choose to. And that's, I think when you asked me earlier about motivation, I think that helps me stay motivated because I don't know where the books are going to go until they're done being written. And so it's almost like reading a book for me, and that as the story unfolds, I learn more about it. And so, you know, with this particular character with the weird name of Pixie, that's not her real name, but that's what everybody calls her.
Yeah.
She was such a timid person. It just seemed right that she would have somebody really, really alpha and overpowering, but also a good, a really good person that would come in, and they would have sort of a cosmic match that you wouldn't expect because they were so very, very different.
Yeah. Yeah. And they are great characters. Her son, I loved. Do you have young children in your life? Because it was some of the things he said were so spot on. I could just hear the toddler voice, you know, it's my baby.
My baby. Well, I remember mine being that age and being very demanding about everything. So, and then I have a friend who has three young daughters. Let me tell you, the differences between toddler boys and toddler girls is night and day, but in most cases, maybe not always, but in most cases. And so I was able to see both. And, you know, my sister has some young ones, and I would write and say, do you remember what happened at this age and what happened at that age? And I would get hold of my friend and say, you know, how would they put this sentence together? Her kids talked really, really young. Mm-hmm. One of mine did, the other two did not. You know, one of mine was super fast physically just because he was so strong. You know, kids are all so very, very different that I tried to show those differences too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love that. So you come up with the characters. I'm guessing you're a discovery writer. You write as you go. You don't outline.
No, I don't outline. Yeah. You know, publishers usually want an idea of what the story will be. So I come up with something.
Yeah.
But I don't really know until I'm writing it exactly what's going to happen. Or I can at least just tell them who the characters are.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I'll say they're going to have a conflict. I don't know what yet. They'll resolve it. I don't know how yet. You know.
Well, hopefully after 100 books, they trust you, right? So you don't have to get too much.
Luckily they do, yeah. Luckily they do. And that's the thing, too, when newer writers ask me for advice, they're not going to be able to do it the way I do it because you have to earn that through trial and error, which I know. So, I mean, I remember it from, you know, however many years ago it was. So I say I can give you advice on protecting your voice and trying to stay motivated, but the entire... I don't really believe in a writing process anyway. Like when I go to classes where they're telling you how to write, because I never wrote the way any of them said. Yeah. And I think it's something a very, very individual thing that each author has to find what works for him or her. Yeah. And I think if you start out trying to fit a mold of what someone tells you, this is how it should be, you kind of sabotage yourself right up front. So I think you really have to sit down and find out what works for you. If you have to outline, outline. If you don't, you know, if you just want to get started, get started. If you, you know, I have author friends who write the ending first, you know, which I can't even imagine. The story would be blown and I would lose my motivation. I have people that do storyboards and they fit them together, and some write scenes and then take them out of sequence. I'm a lineal writer. So I sit down, I start at the beginning and I write to the end. And I surprise myself along the way. So I think each author just has to find what works for their voice and their method.
Yeah, I think the right way to write is the way that works for you.
And that you can be productive and happy.
Exactly. And it evolves. It's not always the same for every book. So yeah, it's an interesting art form. So you have written, I think, entirely romance? I know most of the books in your catalog or romance book. Is that
romance fiction? And then I wrote some urban fantasy at one point, which I loved and always wanted to visit again. I used my initials, LL Foster, but LL Foster didn't make nearly as much money as Laurie Foster. So it was very easy for Laurie Foster to get lured into a new contract without allotting time for LL to get going. So
yeah, urban fantasy had a moment, but I felt like it never really picked up the way that it could. Maybe it'll come back. These things all come back around, you know?
Well, it was funny because when I wrote the L.L. Foster books, one of them was named like the best selling romance for Amazon or something like that. Editor's pick for best romance. And it surprised me. I thought, Well, I didn't even realize there was that much romance in it, but apparently there was.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I could write women's fiction or urban fantasy or anything without some romance in it. You know, that just seems to be where my brain takes a story. I want everyone to find love.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I've never really understood really the difference between women's fiction other than it doesn't maybe have a happy ending.
Yeah, I don't know. Mine always have happy endings. I don't think I could. I couldn't torture myself like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love a happy ending, and you write romance, so you must love happy endings. What do you love about writing romance? What do you love about the genre?
You know, I love the characters. I think that's what I was always missing. When you're in school and they assign you books, the characters just aren't as developed. It's often more about plot or about a message. And then you pick up a romance novel or a women's fiction with romance in it, and it's all about the characters. And it's like you get to know these people, and they're real. They could almost be friends or neighbors or relatives. They could almost be you. And it's just very, very easy to relate and engage and enjoy them. It's funny because my movie preferences is more horror and action. But for reading, I like romance.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I like something that you had said online, because, you know, people often say, oh, romance is an escape. But you had said, you know, no, these are people with real problems and they overcome them and they end up happy. And isn't that, that's kind of what we all want. I think, you know, the hope in the genre and the characters and the real problems are why people love it so much. Why it is the best selling genre.
You know, any problem that I could come up with for in a book, someone has actually lived.
Yeah.
And so when you come up with these stories, I mean, I've written human trafficking with happy endings. I mean, I've written a lot of stuff that gets pretty deep. People have lived those things.
Yeah.
And they've sometimes, most times we hope, come out on the other side and they've survived. And I feel like there always has to be a path for that. And in my books, no matter what these people go through, they have to be able to find the other side. And so I've written books where people would write me and say, you know, that was so much like my story. I went through that. And it was cathartic to read this and see that this person managed to pull herself back together and found love and found her place in the world. Because I don't think that's always very easy. And I don't think we always cover that. But it can, like I said, I believe sometimes you go down these awful paths and then a door opens and you think, well, you know, I went through all of this, but now I'm here and I've found this place with meaning. So I think that's what it is about romance that I like so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I like, you know, it really is about strength and knowing you can survive and come out the other side. Okay. Right.
Well, yeah, romance will get the rep for just being frivolous and being silly. And it's really, really not. That comes from people, I think, who haven't read it.
Yep.
Or have read too that they interpreted that way. And I think anyone who's actually read much of the genre and read very widely across authors, I just think they're completely missing the message.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of cold heart they have, but I think they're just missing it.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I don't want to get on this because there is nothing that makes me madder than when someone, you know, disparages a genre for not being literary enough or whatever.
Right.
And yeah.
Not being lofty enough.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay.
Entertaining people isn't important. It is.
Yeah.
You know, people need to be entertained.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I've probably reiterated this so many times on the podcast, but you know, it's like, there's nothing better about a genre where you're stronger alone and
right,
there's
yeah.
no weakness in being stronger together, but we won't go down that path.
Excellent. Love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. 100 books. You've been doing this for a while. You've seen a lot of changes in the publishing industry, I'm sure. Have any of them been challenging to navigate? Have you had to pivot? Like, what does that look like for you in your career?
Well, yeah, I mean, just recently with so many bookstores closing down and places like Meijer and Walmart and Target shrinking their bookshelves, and you see this slow suck of Amazon just taking over, and it almost seems like publishers hand it to them. You know, they just, their prices I don't want to diss anybody here. I love my publishers, but book prices go up, Amazon prices go down. And little by little, they're destroying their own industry, I think.
Yeah.
So many authors I know are many of them that were traditionally published are now just published through Amazon because that seems to be the place where they can stay active. And, you know, when mass market went away, that was a shocker because that was my favorite. I love to hold a mass market book.
Yeah.
Trade books felt big and awkward to me. And I understood that they were getting more popular. I'm old. Young people like different things. But it just seems such a shame that somebody didn't see that as an opening and somehow do something with that. I'm not an entrepreneur, you know, but it just seems like that would have been a great opening for somebody to keep the market competitive. Luckily, we have a lot of niche bookshops, you know, and little places that are doing things. And I guess Barnes & Noble is picking up again. But last few Barnes & Nobles I was in, their romance sections have shrunk and other sections have gotten bigger. It seems to be very heavy on biographies and that sort of thing. So,
yeah,
I don't know. It's just a very, very different place. You know, I see so many people struggling with it because of how it's changed. And I feel like, and I've told this before to other people, but I feel like I spent many years pushing this boulder up a hill to get to where I was happy with my career. And I'm very happy with my career. And now I feel like that boulder's starting to slide back down the hill and I'm just going to get out of the way.
Yeah.
I'm old enough and comfortable enough that I can just get out of the way and write the books that I like writing, publish fewer and just be happy. You know, I don't feel like I'm having to push for more any longer.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been where I wanted to be and I can relax now.
Yeah. I love that. Cause there are, Amazon was taking on, we know that they don't care if they make money on books cause that's not how they make their money. So they can put the prices really low and sell other things in the same cart. I'm hopeful that there's a resurgence coming along with bookshop.org and more indie stores are opening.
Right.
Younger people are liking analog. So I'm hoping it's swinging back the other way, but yeah, it's been a weird place. You know, 10 years ago it was social media doesn't sell books. And now traditional publishing is like, you need social media. And you do well with that. Has that always been something that you've done that you enjoy or is that more of a recent development?
You know, I have no idea how I ended up with so many people on my Facebook page. I think it's because I don't nonstop push books.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the energy to nonstop push books. I like talking with people and just sharing and being friendly and learning more about people. So for me, I think that's what I try to tell authors, don't make every post about your book because they already know about your book. You know, give a book away and then talk about other things. And I don't see very many people doing that. I think they feel like if they're going to waste the time on social media, they want it to be promotion of some sort. And I don't know. I've just never really approached it that way. I like to talk about other authors. When I've read an author I like, I love to tell everybody about that author. And then if another reader, I consider myself a reader. If another reader likes them too, or tries them and likes them, that's it. I love that. That's mega fun for me to get to share that. So that's something else I also enjoy doing. And I've always done. I don't feel like talking about another author, pushing another author in any way detracts from me.
Right.
And there are authors that I read their books and I love them and I give them 5 stars. And I think they do like a cursory read for me and they'll give me 3 stars. And I think, it doesn't bother me. I don't care. Whatever, everybody's got to do what they've got to do and it's fine. And I'm just very comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I think that's a good message here. You can only do so much by my book. You know, if people are there on your social media, they want to know about you as a person and what, you know, I love giving reading recommendations too when I found a good book because we are readers. We're not just writers, right? We're readers. We want to share the love of reading. People don't just buy one book a year, you know, so it's okay. Yeah, that's fantastic. So I appreciate you sharing all your insights. Just as we're wrapping up here, I'd just like to ask, you know, for newer writers, aspiring writers, if you had some advice you could offer now, what would it be?
You know, my number one thing, and it might not apply to everybody, is too many cooks spoil the stew. You know, I think newer authors so often want to write a chapter and then pass it around to a critique group or get feedback on it. And if they get any criticism, then they feel funny about it and they want to fix it. I think you just really, really need to write your book, finish your book, do the best you can with it in the way that works for you, and then send it to an editor. If you have someone that checks it for typos or, you know, that sort of thing, but don't let other people tell you how to write your book. The only unique thing any author in this business has anymore is her voice. Mm-hmm. And if your voice has input from five other people, it's not really your voice anymore. That's how I've always felt about it. I have an awesome street team, and they'll sometimes read a book for me just to check for typos or, you know, timing problems. But I've never wanted anyone to tell me how to write my books. And I've been fortunate that editors haven't even really told me how to write my books. Occasionally I get some edits, but they're never very heavy-handed. And I think that's in part because I write the book the best that I can and the way that in my heart I know it needs to be written. And I think that's important for new authors. I think when you put yourself through too much torture with other people, you lose your motivation, you lose your pacing, and you lose your voice. So, you know, yeah. But again, somebody might really, really need all that. So I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, voice is so important. Whenever, you know, agents are looking for something, they're looking for voice, and it's so important, and you can't teach it. And I think you're right. Writing by committee and getting your voice diluted is not the way to go. Doesn't mean you shouldn't take feedback, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to write by committee.
And you, especially if you're a new author and your editor gives you feedback, you want to listen to that because you yep. want to be able to get published. If you get published enough, then, you know, they'll start trusting you more with it. But in the beginning, you really have to just jump through those hoops and get it out there and see where it goes. A lot of nice new voices out there.
I really liked this interview. I loved that she said the more she doesn't sell, the more determined she became that she would. I think it kind of goes back to like that writing. It's spite adjacent, I guess, but just sort of like that tenacity and determination. Like, have early in your career, like, did you ever feel like that? Like that you just, if you didn't sell, you were just became more determined to do it? Or was it more discouraging?
I've been pretty lucky as far as sales go. So I haven't been there yet. Hopefully that never happens.
Yeah.
I sold my first book, but then I ended up having to buy it back for reasons. But I think if I didn't have this attitude, I wouldn't have a career because I just kept writing and publishing as a kind of F you to the people that were gatekeeping.
Yeah. Well, she just, you know, when she had said that she just likes writing. So I guess it kind of goes hand in hand with just like, well, might as well keep doing it and see what happens.
Well, to be an author, you have to have the tenacity dialed up to 11, I think, at all times to succeed in this particular world.
You do. I always view it like as, I don't know if you remember those clown punching bags. They were like the blow up, you know, and you'd punch it and it bounces right back. You have to be the clown to make it in publishing, like no matter what. Hello, I'm back again.
I feel like that every day.
I feel seen.
Do you think urban fantasy is going to make a comeback?
Has it really left? You, I mean,
I'm not a big urban fantasy reader.
I see urban fantasy releasing all the time. So I just
only from the big names
really
though.
Yeah.
Not from a debut, she says, as someone who wrote an urban fantasy and was rejected specifically because, quote, they couldn't sell it.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, I think everything makes a comeback. And there's an ebb and flow to just every genre, you know, and the things that are hot now are going to cool down. And then someone will come up with something really creative later and it'll just be the same genre. We'll slap a different label on it. Like, that's the way I feel about, lit RPG books are basically just the same as like cyberpunk and, you know.
Well, they're a little bit different, but
for it.
Maybe we need
they're not that different.
Urban romanticy. That might work.
Urban romanticy.
Well, I do think romanticism will actually help with that shift, because I do think, like, once you kind of start getting into just a fantasy romance, like, those like edges get blurred a little bit. And so instead of calling it urban fantasy, I think you'll probably just start seeing it labeled as more romanticism, I think. But I don't know. I hope so. I like urban fantasy. I think it's a lot of fun, so. Do you prefer different genres when it comes to what you watch and what you read, or do you stick to the same thing? I know, JD, you're pretty, you like things to explode.
I do. Yeah, and I mean, part of my problem is if I start watching another genre like on Netflix or something like that, or I start reading books like that, then all of a sudden I want to write that. And I would get in a lot of trouble if I did that. I mean, I stopped watching Star Trek for that very reason. Like, I love Star Trek, and I used to watch all of them, even the crappy ones. But like, it always made me want to sit down and write a sci-fi novel. And like, that's just not where
Sci-fi
my world is at.
thriller. Come
Yeah, I mean,
on.
well, that's a little different. But like, I'm thinking more like a space opera kind of thing. You know, like something that just takes place in the far future. Everything in space. Everybody's in spaceships and like that. You
Use
know,
a pen name.
yeah. When we have 30 hours in the day, maybe I'll figure out how to do
Okay, all
that.
right.
J.B. Darker.
Gee.
I like pretty much all genres. I mean, there's very little that I don't want to consume, and I do let it influence the writing, and I do sometimes try my hand at writing those things, and then what ends up happening is the stuff that isn't really going to stick, it ends up falling away. So like, if I watch, I don't know, if I read a romanticy and get it in my head, I'm going to write a romanticy. I'll probably be halfway through it before they discover some lost artifact, and bam, it's a archaeological thriller now. So, I'm going to come back around on the genres that I'm proficient at. I like sci-fi. I've written sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers. I just haven't written romance or anything like that yet.
Well, honestly, romance is the only one that translates, because like, you can throw romance into pretty much any kind. It could be a horror novel, and you can throw a romance in there, and it's going to work.
True.
So I've read a lot of romance just to figure out how to, weave that into various storylines. I mean, my wife and I right now we're watching the JFK Jr. Carolyn Bessette thing called Love Story, and it's actually pretty good. You know, so like, it gives you ideas, that you might use later.
Yeah, that was a good. Ryan Murphy is always he's I like Ryan Murphy a lot. But Kevin, your last book that I read had a very significant romance subplot in it.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So
Yeah. So, and then some of the notes I got on it were to amp that up. So be even more romantic.
Well, I think romance is kind of an interesting thing, and I think the reason it translates to so much is because there's just natural tension in romance. And so,
Yeah.
if you're trying to create tension, tension is what you need in a plot, and I think it just helps it amplifies horror, it amplifies thrillers, it amplifies comedy. I don't know.
Great for a subplot.
Yes.
All right. Well, on that note, JD, who do we got coming up next week?
So I don't know if you guys looked this up. His name's Lee Goldberg. So what I usually do for prep for the show is I'll load up their Amazon page or find their website, look at their bio, and then clip a couple of sentences. But this guy starts off by saying he's a number one New York Times bestseller, ex-Navy SEAL, this, that. And then like a paragraph in, he says that, well, that's all BS. So I am not sure who this guy really is. I mean, best
Oh,
I can
he's a
tell,
character.
he's a television writer. He's worked across a bunch of different genres on the television side, and he also writes novelists. But he's here to talk about his latest book, which is called Murder by Design, which is a thriller releasing June 1st. So Lee Goldberg.
Lee Goldberg, looking forward to it. All right. Well, if you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. And we'll see you next episode. Have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.